Chatter on books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
All right. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope everyone is doing well, staying healthy, wearing masks, etc. In just a little bit, we'll be talking to our very first author ever, who is, I'm going to read this to make sure I get it right, an officer of the Order of the British Empire. And quite simply, this means he's smarter than any one of us on the show.
He's a big time, big shot.
It's a low bar, big shot. And he's done extraordinary things in his field, which I've come to learn is a very diverse field. It is Simon Winchester who has brought us The Madman and the Professor, Krakatoa, The Map That Changed the World, Perfectionist, many others. And he now has an absolutely fabulous book called Land, How Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. I've read it. I've read sections of it again. I feel smarter already. Some of them I had to reread a couple, but fabulous stories. Most importantly, joined tonight, Claude's doing all the important work. And David Aldridge, of course, has his glass of wine. He's ready to rock and roll. Jamie McIntyre, speaking of great voices. Okay, everybody, how's the snow treating you? Because we are in the nation's capital of...
This was nice. All right, so I just got in from clearing my driveway just moments before we recorded this. And, you know, the first couple of times you shovel, it's okay. But now we've got this layer of ice.
Yeah.
And I'm leaning on my shovel and my neighbor says to me, yeah, how's it going? And I said, well, I'm reconsidering my strategy. And he says, how's that? I said, I'm considering waiting for warmer weather. And then... He says, it's the ice, right? And I said, yeah, the ice is a pain in the neck. And he comes back and he has this long handle. So this is a practical tip, by the way. So he has this long handled garden implement that looks kind of like a spade, but it's got a flat edge at the end. Mm-hmm. And he says, here, use this. And I said, well, you know, I don't want to be just chopping the ice. That sounds like a lot of work. And he said, no, you just run this underneath. And he runs it under the thing and magically, all of the ice and snow is chopped up into little pieces, which you can then easily just push to the side. And it was effortless. It took a little longer, but it was effortless. And I said, how is it I got to this point living in this area, living through all those blizzards and did not know this trick?
Because this is unusual for the Washington, D.C. area. Usually we have snow for a day and then it's 50 degrees and it does melt and it goes away. So this one's been hanging on for a couple of days. Yes. David, how's it treating you?
It's fine. I realize now how easy it is to clear snow when someone else actually does it.
In Washington, we don't do anything. We hire people.
No. I have a 13-year-old in the house. And so he cleaned a lot of the snow. And
do you pay him?
God, no. Oh. He already gets an allowance. You don't get extra. That's part of the compact. You know?
All right. How much?
I cleaned off the cars. I did that.
That's
good.
Did you put the windshield wipers out so they...
I did not do that. Yeah. I just warmed the cars up and let them kind of heat, and I brushed the snow off. The snow broom, greatest invention ever. I don't know who did it. I hope they're a billionaire. I bought it like 10 years ago. Still use it. It's fantastic.
People think they tune into this show to hear about books. They get snow tips, snow shovel tips. Snow
broom is a book on snow blowers or something.
Yes.
A friend of mine in Denver, has a house in Denver, told me that, you know, snowblowers are really big out there and they come with features that you don't really find here, like heated handles that you hold when you hold onto the handles. They're heated.
Yeah.
He said headlights. You need headlights out in Denver.
Yeah.
It's like, really?
So we should have gotten into this snow survival last week with John Hudson.
Yes.
Mr. Survival. What we didn't get to, and we just ran out of time, but I thought he was fabulous. But he had this great thing in his book, which is about books. And that is, he went and did this study and talked to some people and found out that reading is one of the best ways to reduce stress. It was in the section of his book about dealing with the pandemic, and we didn't have that much time to talk about it. But somebody, it was in the UK, as a matter of fact, did the study. And they say that reading a book is 68% better at reducing stress than music, that it is 300% better than going for a walk. I don't know if I agree with that one. Mm-hmm. And it is 700% better than playing video games.
What about drinking whiskey?
Yeah, I think
that's it. Is that on the list?
If you're going for efficiency, I'm going to go with the whiskey. Okay. I thought that was great. And yes. And they distinguish between actually physically holding a real book. We've talked about this before. Do you read a book? Do you use a Kindle, etc.? But physically holding a book, because it just slows you down. There's a certain rhythm to turning the pages. I love that. Okay. Any chance I get to talk about Herman Melville and trash Moby Dick, I will take it. So the other day, Robert Gottlieb in the New York Times had this long review about the posthumous book done, The Bright Book of Life by Harold Bloom. Harold Bloom, one of those people far smarter than any one of us besides Simon Winchester. And he wrote about the books that he reads and rereads and rereads. And of course, someone like Gottlieb makes it all about himself. But Bloom, who is a Yale professor, literary critic, really, really smart guy, read and reread Shakespeare, Melville, went on for chapters, evidently, in this book about Moby Dick, which we know just discounts him completely because we're going to get rid of Moby Dick. He reread Wordsworth, Whitman, Tolstoy, Melville. So, David, do you ever reread books? You're physical.
Oh, sure. Yes. Absolutely.
Which ones
do you read? I don't know. I mean, I've read, you know, the books that I really like. I like, you know, the political books that I've talked about a million times.
Right.
All the President's Men and What It Takes and all those things. I read those all the time.
What will cause you to go, you know what? I just want to pull that one off the shelf and take a look again.
A quote, something I remember, a line that I remember from that book. And I'll go, where was that in that book? And I'll go back and find the chapter. And all of a sudden, well, I got to start at the beginning of the chapter to get the context of the quote. Uh-huh. And then I'm in again, you know, so all kinds of books, not too many biographies. I think I'm a one and done with biographies. I don't usually go back to read someone's biography again, but the, you know, the nonfiction stuff, I'm fascinated by.
Interesting. Jamie, do you reread anything?
Yeah. So my go-to reread is a series I picked up when I was in college in Florida at the University of Florida. And my wife introduced me to this mystery writer named John D. McDonald. He wrote this whole series of books with a character named Travis McGee. And they're just wonderfully written. He also wrote, I mean, you may know him from he wrote Cape Fear.
Okay, gotcha.
But he wrote this Travis McGee series, and they all take place in Florida, and they all have these sort of rambling observations about life in Florida and life in general. And he's this kind of, you know, he's kind of a Jack Reacher kind of guy who is very self-sufficient and gets in battles and stuff. But the lure of the books is that as all the commentary on Florida in the 60s and 70s and what it was like, and just the writing is so smart. And so even though some of the books don't hold up kind of socially from what we would think of today, when I'm at the beach and I just want to lose myself, I just pick up one of the 21 Travis McGee books and read one of those again.
And you have all 21.
I do. I'm all I'm numbered on my shelf.
So it's kind of like comfort food.
It very is. And and I just enjoy the writing. I read it and I think, I wish I could write like this.
Yeah.
And I think you talked about reading being good for stress relaxation. It's also good if reading is the best way to learn how to write, by finding people that you really admire who have this economy of words, who are able to convey these things and that are easy to read. John D. McDonald is my go-to comfort read.
Before doing the show, I used to reread a lot more. Now there's just not as much time. And I feel as though, no, I've got 15 books I need to read, which I want to read. So I don't have that luxury. I used to take Robert Caro books off, who wrote about LBJ.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Off the shelf. Just phenomenal. And to Jamie's point about how well written they are. And he did incredible research about the smallest of details about the hill country of Texas.
Right.
And you're sitting there reading it going, I don't care about the hill country of Texas, but I care about the hill country of Texas. And it's just, I'm so in awe. So sometimes when I'm completely overwhelmed, which is about 16 times a day, I would pull one of those off the shelf and just go, wow.
Did he say he's got one more Lyndon Johnson book in him or no? Is he done with that now?
No, that sounds right. We might imagine it, but that sounds right.
Yeah. I think he has one more. No, they're great books. They're all wonderful books.
I read his book and I interviewed him back in 2001, in the summer of 2001, when I did a story on CNN about LBJ's Phony Baloney Silver Star, which is
today.
But LBJ wore a Silver Star lapel pin on his suit jacket his entire for a completely talk about stolen honor. A story for another day.
We talked about the consequentialness of Lyndon Johnson, who who really should have been in prison, much instead of being president. But he wasn't. And because of him, everything, the world changed because he became president of the United States. It's amazing.
I may have told you guys this, but when I was very young, Lyndon, I was sort of, I had no idea really what the president of the United States did, but somebody told me that Lyndon Johnson was a cowboy and he wore cowboy hats. And I thought, mm-hmm. well, that was cool because I like cowboys and horses and everything else. And then I wake up one day, and whether it was on television or the newspapers, he's holding up his dog by his ears. That was it. No one in our house was ever allowed to mention LBJ again after that. Okay. The other thing Harold Bloom was very into was poetry.
Yes.
We have mixed feelings about poetry on this show. Very mixed feelings. And I threw out my beret, so I couldn't put it on. But another thing we didn't get to last week, and I really wanted to, was Amanda Gorman, our National Youth Poet Laureate, who spoke at Biden's inauguration, who was phenomenal. Jamie, did you watch? Did you like her as opposed to other things in the inauguration?
I was transfixed by her.
Why? Tell us why.
Well, first of all, I wasn't even aware we had a youth poet laureate. She was so...
Thank God we did, because otherwise we would have had some 99-year-old up there.
She was so accomplished. And... you know, afterwards, I wasn't sure I could recall the lines of the poetry. I was so transfixed by them.
Right.
But immediately when I went online, I couldn't find the poem, although I found it on a transcription service that had some mistakes in it. But
The Hill We Climb.
It was really terrific in the fact that if you don't like poetry, often it's because, you know, you have to read it. And this was really not just she had written the poem, but the way she performed the poem, the spoken quality, the way she, the wordplay that she used. I think one of my favorite parts was where she was, and I don't have the poem in front of me, but it was something about how what just is, isn't justice.
Yeah. And, the rhythm. The
in a way, it was sort of evocative to me of, you know, sort of almost like how Hamilton struck me. And like a lot of people, first of all, when I was a kid, I memorized tons of poems. I can recite them all for you here. We won't have to do any more guests. I can just give you poems. But I can't remember poems now. But the kids these days, nobody does. And, you know, I subscribe to The New Yorker, and The New Yorker has poems in every issue. And I find it hard for me to get to actually force myself to read them. Mm-hmm. But if someone reads me the poem, like, say, Garrison Keillor on the Writer's Almanac podcast, speaking of short podcasts, I really can find them quite engaging. And I think the problem is we don't read poems out loud anymore. Anyway, she was absolutely terrific.
We do at inaugurations and other big signature events. But David, what did you think?
Well, I thought she was terrific. It had to do with the moment and the hope that the country had that we could finally kind of turn the page and go forward. And who better to kind of evoke that hope than a young person of color kind of expressing herself? I just thought it was terrific. And the poem was fantastic. I think it was, and I say this because I don't know anything about poetry. And I say this is a complete, you know, null set when it comes to poetry. But I thought her imagery was very easy for people to understand. I think part of the problem with a lot of modern day poetry is that it is so insular and the meaning of it is so hidden in what the author of the poem is trying to say.
Often deliberately so.
Yeah, and that's okay because they're sometimes talking about very painful things and things that are difficult to discuss and to talk about, but it makes it very kind of difficult to understand the meaning of the poem. You know, you want to be sympathetic and empathetic, but sometimes the imagery is so kind of opaque that it's just very difficult. Whereas her imagery is very kind of easy, I think, and digestible. And we all kind of understood the visual cues she was giving us through her language. And it was wonderful. But I think Jamie's right. We just don't read enough poetry, I think, to be intelligent about poetry anymore in this country, you know?
Right. Well, and I will never be intelligent about it.
No,
I was stunned by it. And I had kind of heard that they were going to have a young person, the national. So I thought, okay, fine. And then, you know, I'm just watching who's sitting where, Bernie's mittens. Bernie's mittens, quite possibly the greatest thing that's happened so far this year. and then she stood up and to command that kind of stage the way she did, and the presence she had and the accessibility. I felt as though she and I were the only ones in a room and she's telling me the story. It didn't sound like poetry to me, partly because what you said, Jamie, the rhythm of her words and the balance of her words. You're right, David. I have no idea if those are the right expressions. And the brilliance of what she said, because it was realistic yet hopeful.
Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to if you're commissioned to write a poem for an inauguration, because there's so many things you have to project hope, but you're trying not to sound trite and
think about the few cliches, the couple of weeks before the inauguration,
and you don't want to annoy the people who didn't vote for the person who won. So you want to sort of touch all these things, and she managed to do that. I mean, there's a couple of lines in the poem that might be kind of a little bit trite or something, but overall, it was a masterpiece, especially when you consider compared to anything I wrote at that age.
For example,
usually five lines, and the first and the second line rhymed, and so did the last.
So she has two books coming out. They're not yet out, but pre-sales already put them on just racing up the bestseller list. And this is the a headline in the New York Times the other day. Amanda Gorman, poet, gets modeling agent and a stage at the Super Bowl. David, I don't always like to go to you just for sporty stuff. Has there ever been a poet at a Super Bowl?
Can't think of one, unless you count Prince.
Which I do.
Yeah, no poets that I can think of. I can't remember Maya Angelou ever, waxing poetic before the coin toss. So they did. I just can't remember. I drink a lot, as you know. So.
As David knows, for years and years and years, I have trashed the NFL for the Super Bowl and what they try to do to the Super Bowl. And they try to appeal to everybody. I mean, you've already got 1.5 billion people, but let's torture the halftime entertainment and everything else to try to get another 1 billion people. And it's ridiculous. But this year, especially challenging, and a lot of the people that a lot of the companies that normally would advertise have pulled out because it's not the right time to be doing a really funny $5 million ad or whatever. I thought it was brilliant on the part of the NFL, and they don't do too many brilliant things, but to tap her and ask her to do that, I thought it was great. Yeah. Absolutely great.
So David and Tori, I have to ask both of you. So do either one of you know any poems by heart that you could recite if you had to? You don't have to do it now. I just wondered if you do.
I know the first few lines. What's the...
You don't have to say.
The Coleridge poem. What's the Coleridge poem that everybody knows? What is it? I feel like an idiot now. In Xanadu to Kubla Khan, a stately play.
Oh, there we go.
Invictus? Are you talking about? No.
No, not Invictus. But...
You guys need to stop. Simon Winchester is going to go away.
As he should. Because he's way smart.
Do you know any poems by heart?
Jamie, at one time, I think in the first 6 months of this show, it might have been National Poetry Week or whatever. So everybody had to talk about their favorite poem and read it. And of course, smart people like David are coming up with Coleridge and others. And I said, swear to God, the only poems I can remember, and I won't embarrass all of us by doing this, they were these horrible limerick kind of things called Little Willie poems. And I'll just leave it at that. Listening, the 75,000 people listening to this show can just Google Little Willie poems. You could wake me up from a dead sleep at 3:30 in the morning and I could do Little Willie poems. So there we go. Enough. We're moving on. Simon Winchester, are you still with us?
I am, and I can recite a poem if you like.
There you go.
Go right ahead with that great accent.
Of course he can, because he's British. British people can recite poetry.
It's Philip Larkin. It's called This Be the Verse. Has two improper words in it. I hope that's all right.
It's a podcast. Go for it.
Podcast. Go.
They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They give you all the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by old school fools in hats and coats, who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself.
Wow.
That's outstanding.
We should just stop the show now.
The show's over. That's it. We can't go better than that, right?
But I want to show you one other thing, because it's snowing so heavily up here. I'm in Western Massachusetts. My dear son sent me from London, where he is in the alcohol industry, a drink maybe you're all familiar with, called a Rocky Mountain Sneezer. Ooh. You take 2 ounces of brandy, 2 ounces of aged rum, juice of a lemon, 2 teaspoons of sugar to taste, 2 dashes of Angostura bitters. Combine the ingredients in a cocktail shaker and stir until the sugar is dissolved. Add a good handful of snow, preferably from the Rocky Mountains, and shake well, pour into an old-fashioned glass, and top with fresh snow.
Oh,
that sounds fabulous.
That sounds so good.
Fabulous. All right, commercial break. We'll all run out.
I'll go pack up some snow right now.
Awesome. Simon Winchester, thank you so much for joining us. And thank the lovely and talented Jane Byrne at Simon & Schuster for making this happen. So there are so many things. There were so many fabulous stories in your latest book, Land. And we'll get to not enough of them, but we'll get to them. But on this show, we love to talk a little bit about people's backstories. And you grew up a very unusual child. Can we start with you blowing up the lab in boarding school?
Oh, gosh, I didn't think you'd start with that. Well, yes, I mean, I was, it's quite simple, really. I was I was actually at a boarding school in Dorset in southwest England called Hardy's School, but not named after Thomas Hardy. And we were playing cricket. And I think I was out, so that meant I had nothing to do for the next hour or so. And I was, I was 18, I was head of school. So I was the big
chief. So you had done something, you had had some accomplishments up till now.
Sort of, yes. I mean, I got a place at university and blah, blah, blah. So it was the last 5 or 6 days of summer term. And there was a boy called Wood, I remember, who was not, I was doing A-level chemistry, physics and zoology, and he was doing something like Latin, French and Greek or something, so completely different subjects. And we had this brand new science building, chemistry building, science, I think, I forget. Anyway, the chemistry labs were on the top floor, and I said, because I had nothing to do, did he want to come up and see the lab? And he said, oh, yeah, I'm sure he wasn't interested at all, but he came up. So it was on the third floor, and it was this gleaming, you know, retorts and all kinds of impressive looking stuff. And beautiful, beautiful mahogany benches. And I said, would you like to see an experiment? And he said, well, I'd love to. So I got the most spectacular thing I could think of was called the thermite experiment, which is when you get a mixture of aluminum, and magnesium oxides, which is a gray sort of powder. And it's used in industry for fusing together tram lines because it burns at incredibly high temperature. So I got a crucible, filled it with this powder, which I made. It only takes about 10 minutes to make. And you put it on a gauze, put it on a tripod, and then put in a strip of magnesium ribbon to act as a igniter. Lit it, and I said, stand back. And the magnesium went into the grey powder, which instantly, there was a sort of Krakatoa of flame and fire and stuff. And this huge nugget, not just of white fire, but of blue fire. It was so hot. And it burned immediately through the gauze, dropped onto the bench below, like in the scene from Alien, dropped through that, burned through it. I saw it burn through the floor. We rushed down to the next floor below. Sure enough, it was coming out of the ceiling, dropped through that bench, went down 3 floors. And it did 10 or 15,000 pounds worth of damage. And A.N. Hamilton, the headmaster, who later went on, I remember, retired and went on to breed greyhounds, I think. But he called me into the study, and I said, Winchester, he said, I'm terribly sorry to have to say that Mr. Barris, the chemistry master, has said that the cost of repairing the laboratory is such that I think perhaps it would be a wise thing if you left school.
Wow.
So pack your bags.
You know, in America, we have a term for that kind of, called the, can you hold my beer moment? I know that they don't have all the same phrases over in the UK because I've been watching Ted Lasso on.
That's fabulous. Okay.
Fantastic.
So you blow up the lab and then somehow you get to hitchhiking all over the United States. How did that happen?
I left school, if I got it right. So I'm now 17, I suppose. But I've taken a year off, you know, a gap year, as they call it in Europe. And I think it's becoming quite a fashionable thing to do in this country. Yes. So I had a year off and I had a girlfriend in Montreal called Carol Blaine.
How did you find Carol Blaine in Montreal if you're living?
Well, it's funny you should say that because there's a connection only 2 days ago. In 1961, there was a children's science fair in London where people from all over the world gathered and showed experiments. And I had some hydroponic tomato thing. I can't even remember.
Probably of course you did.
Well, yeah, of course I did, right? And I met two people there, 17-year-old or 16-year-old, as cute as a button, Carol Blaine from Montreal, and William Geffen from Tulsa. And Bill Geffen lives now in Washington, D.C., and I don't know if this is live or not, but may be watching. He remains a friend of mine after however many years that is, 16.
Wow, oh, small goodness. World.
And I went and lived in Tulsa with his family, and sort of I know a few things about Oklahoma as a result. Anyway, so I needed to go and see Carol because I felt the kind of 17-year-old love one gets for a 16-year-old. So I had to earn enough money to go and see her. And I got a job working, because I had done biology and zoology at A-level, and working in a mortuary in North London.
Oh my God.
And my job was opening up the bodies of people who had lately passed away.
Okay, and this is not on your website. Just a commercial break
it's
here.
It's not something I put Simon Winchester.
Simon Winchester has one of the best author websites I've seen in 2.5 years of doing this show. It's a fabulous website and a very honest bio of yourself. You did not mention the mortuary. This is
it's a bit grisly, really. And so I went to open the bodies up. Then the mortician, who astonishingly was called Dr. Fleischhacker. German lady who would do with
you're
it.
You're making that up, sir.
I promise you I'm not. I don't know who's saying this, but I'm not. If it's you, Jamie, I'm not. She was furiously while she was doing the investigation.
And I happen to know a lot of flesh hackers myself, so
well, okay.
It didn't surprise me at all.
Anyway, can I just very briefly tell a small story from that? I mean, I know this is supposed to be books, but so I would, after she had decided how this person had died, would sew them up and they'd be dealt with. So on this particular morning, I came in and there was a chap with a query on his toe. It's an elderly gentleman. And it said query leukemia. So there was a handbook of what you do. You remove the femur. So I made an incision in his leg, took out the thigh bone, sent it off to the path lab to be investigated. And then I sewed him up afterwards. But of course, his leg kept flopping off the table. So I, you know, and the undertaker came round to pick it up, to take it away. And he said, oh, I can't tell you that. He said, my legs keep flopping off the table. I said, I don't know what to do. I'm new here. And he said, well, put something in the leg to stiffen it up. I'll come back after dinner and pick it up at 2. So he went away and I looked around in the backyard of this mortuary and I found a piece of drain pipe about 18 inches long and cut it to the right length with a hacksaw, stuffed it between his patella and his pelvis. Leg shot out like a ramrod. Stitched him up, put on his trousers. Just in time, the chap came round, signed for the body, took it away, and everything would have been fine except the next day, the body was cremated. And when they were raking through the ashes, 18 inches of red hot drain pipe, and I got a terrible wigging and nearly lost my job. But anyway, I didn't got to see Carol, and she's now a professor at the University of Michigan.
Wow. Again, I think we should just end the show on that. It's
gonna be I have nothing.
I was going to make a bad pun about whether you couldn't find something humorous in
Very good. I mean, how do you drop the drain pipe in the leg? I don't know. That's just spectacular.
Well, I never do it again. And what I was told, there was a basket full of chair legs for use in those circumstances. But my mother loved me doing the job. It was every evening I'd come home with armloads of slightly wilted flowers.
Okay. All right. So we're going to now greatly collapse the story because I'm just in shock of this. But you hitchhike all over the United States. You thought you were going to be a geologist at one point, right? And that has helped you in a lot of the books you've done. And then you're reading James Morris. Is this right? James Morris before Jan Morris.
Mm-hmm.
And was your inspiration to become a journalist from James/Jan Morris?
May I tell you a true story?
I mean, the others were not true?
Who I revere from your coverage of the Pentagon years ago. I think I'm right, aren't I?
You did? Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. On the 7th of December, which I think was a Wednesday, I found this tin in an attic. And I opened it up. It said SW Personal. And it had a bunch of letters. And the topmost letter which I haven't seen for since the 7th of September, 1966, came to me in my tent in Uganda, where I was living and working as a not very good geologist, from Treffen Hall, Llanystumdwy, Cricieth, Wales. Dear Mr. Winchester, thank you for your letter. I'm so glad you enjoyed Coronation Everest, which was the book about climbing Mount Everest, and Oxford. But I fear I can't be much help. There's no way, as far as I know, to learn how to be a writer, blah, 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 blah. If, on the other hand, you don't aim higher than my own level of craftsmanship, then journalism will offer you opportunities both of gathering material and of practicing the craft. Blah, 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 blah. Good luck. Yours sincerely, James Morris. A year later, next letter, believe me, I'll shut up in a moment, which is the 12th of September, 1967. Dear Miss Winch, thank you for your letter. Very nice to hear from you. I congratulate you on pursuing your course so steadfastly as to have joined a newspaper in Newcastle upon Tyne. A third letter.
Wow.
To join The Guardian. And here is the letter from The Guardian offering me a job in 1970 January on James Morris's urging at £30 a week. That's $50 or $45 a week.
Good then.
All these letters I found on this Wednesday in December. And I mean, James, yes, you're right, became Jan, changed genders, whatever you like. She and I have been great friends ever since. We've written a book together. She comes and stays whenever she comes over to America. But she's getting on, so I'm concerned, and we would speak about once a month. So when I found these letters on the Wednesday, I said, I'm going to ring Jan and tell her that the letter that she wrote to me 50 years ago, which turned my life around totally, I found it. So I rang the next day because it was too late on the Wednesday. I rang Thursday at her lunchtime, at her tea time, and at her supper time. And neither she nor her partner, Elizabeth, answered the phone. And I was a bit concerned.
Worrisome.
And following morning, my son, the one that's just sent me that recipe, rang from London to say that Jan had died.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it was so poignant, really.
Very
so
poignant.
She never knew. Well, she did know. She knew what had happened and she knew how grateful I was. But I so wanted to be able to tell her.
Yeah. I'm sure she knew.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Jan Morris inspired so many people, including me, to travel.
Right.
You know, born and raised Pittsburgh, you never went more than 10 miles from home. And it really never occurred to me to be interested in things beyond Pittsburgh, et cetera. The way Jan Morris wrote, you just wanted to be in those places. You wanted to be in Wales. You wanted to be in all those places. Fabulous inspiration. Okay, should we talk about your book? Because we're almost out of time.
Otherwise, Jane will be really cross.
We have about 4 minutes to talk about the book. No, of course.
Usually
no.
Can we find out what the book's about?
Do we have a book this evening? Okay, it's fabulous. It's called Land. Simon, you don't know this, but I hate subtitles on books, but How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. I would love to hear your inspiration for this book because you've written about so many diverse things. And the interesting story that starts this book is your purchasing land in the United States. And the first time it's about 21 years ago now. And it's the first time you had ever bought any land, any property, right?
Yes. I mean, I grew up, my parents were pretty, pretty poor. And at the end of their lives, they had a sort of postage stamp of a garden in the middle of Rutland, in the middle of England. But I'd never imagined owning land. So I'd been living in Hong Kong for 13 years or so, came to America on the urging, oddly enough, of the New York Times correspondent who said that go and live in New England because it sort of looks like England, but it's full of nice. So I bought a little house and in a place called Wassaic in New York State. And there was a chap who came hunting in the land around the house, and he would every autumn leave me a big thing of venison and usually a bottle of cognac as well. He was an extremely generous man. And then one year he said he didn't want to come up very often anymore. Would I like to buy the land? And so I did. And the price was knocked down. It was pretty useless land, but very beautiful. Little streams, and it was on the north face of a mountainside. And I never really thought about it until 2011, when I became a citizen of this country. And I took my citizenship in a ship that Jamie, I assume you'll know, the oldest commissioned warship in the world, the USS Constitution in Boston Harbor. I knew the commander, so they let me be on this ceremony and on the poop deck, and appropriate, I suppose. And so I became a citizen. And then I realized that I owned a piece of America. And that suddenly came home to me. And then I started doing research into who had owned the land before and realized what I'd never really thought about, which is that, you know, Mr. Luria, who I'd bought it from, and the person who he had bought it from, blah, 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 that was all recorded. But you come to a shuddering halt in about 1650, when the first ever sort of deed with a mark made by someone with a drawing of a deer or a little X or something. Prior to that, the Mohicans who had lived there never had a concept of ownership. And so this whole idea that they had never owned anything, and nor had any Native American, nor had any Aboriginal, no Maori, no First Nation in Canada, but we white Westerners had conceived this idea, which was born in England in the 16th century, of owning land. How did that work? Was it a good thing? End of story.
Yeah.
Beginning of story.
I won't do justice to it, but this book covers so many things from the first settlers. Actually, you know, the subtitle, if we were going to write it, Simon Winchester would have been "The White Guys Keep Stealing Stuff." That's essentially what it is. It's the white guys keep stealing stuff.
Me being one of them, of course.
Exactly. Through the whole book. But maps, barbed wire, taking lands, trespassing. It covers so many different wonderful things in this book. How did you sit down and construct it? Did you have a plan from beginning to end, the arc that you wanted to follow?
Yes, and I think that's, quite honestly, if I ever am in the pompous position of teaching writing, which I'm sure no one will ever pay me to do, but I would say there are three components. One, you have to have a good idea. Three, if you can write well, that's a help. But number two is to have a good structure, because you can write lyrically about a very good subject, but if the structure's hopeless, everyone will go to sleep.
Yeah.
So how do you keep them awake and engaged and have a narrative flow? And so I divided this particular book, after a prologue and an epilogue, into five. How do you know whether you know, you've got to know where the land is? How do you get it once you've got it? How do you deal with it? How do you fight over it? Is there a solution to all the problems? So those five things, and there may be many other issues that I didn't cover, and I dare say some reviewer somewhere will say, oh, he never did such and such. But those five topics seem to me to embrace most of the story of land, and to do so in a relatively a structure that is accessible.
It's very, very accessible. As I said at the start of the show, I feel smarter having read this book. And I knew some of the broad strokes, if you will. But I went, oh my gosh, I didn't know that piece of it. And there are so many wonderful little anecdotes in it. The Angle Inlet. I mean, the peculiarities of boundaries and maps. Can you talk about the Angle Inlet?
Yes, well, that was a mismeasurement of the belief, I think, in the 19th century that the Mississippi River, the source was in the Lake of the Woods, in what is now Canada. And the surveying was dreadful. And of course, as we all know, it begins in Lake Itasca in northern Minnesota. And because of this error, the drawing of the borderline between the wiggly part, which is essentially from Maine to just west of Lake Superior, and then it becomes a die straight line all the way to Vancouver, effectively. They screwed it up, basically, because they made this mistake about the location of Mississippi. I mean, to make a very complicated story a little bit simple, which is part of what the book is, it left high and dry a place called Angle Inlet, a town of 130-odd people marooned inside Canada. So to get there, you have to drive to western Minnesota, cross the border into Manitoba, drive north for about 30 miles, then right on a dirt road, that means eastwards, for about 50 miles. And then you come to a little hut, a note saying you're entering the United States.
Right.
They say, what? And there's a hut in which there is a television monitor and a telephone. You pick it up and someone in presumably DC answers it, and you have to present your passport on, and they then let you in. And woe betide you if you don't, because there's so much electronics. When you get there, it's dull as ditchwater. You think, why did I go to all this trouble to go there? But it is one of the weird, I mean, they've got a place called Point Roberts, which is similar in British Columbia. But no, there are these weird eccentricities. The greatest of them all are in Bangladesh, but I'll leave you to...
No. Go. Tell the story.
Well, I mean, the drawing of the border, well, the border between India and Pakistan was this miserable, tragic, tragic business where Lord Mountbatten, having, you know, the British government having decided to give freedom at long last to India, Mountbatten says, I'm going to do it in 8 weeks. So everyone's racing around like chickens with their heads cut off. But Muhammad Ali Jinnah says, despite what Muhammad, you know, Gandhi says, India is not going to be one country. It's going to be two. There's going to be Pakistan, West and East Pakistan. So Mountbatten thinks, well, we've got to draw a border between these two countries. And so he calls a fellow in London, a very, you know, blameless civil servant and lawyer called Sir Cyril Radcliffe, who has never been to India, has never indeed been east of Paris, and come and draw a border line between two countries never heard of.
Right.
So they give him four assistants who never speak to each other. He arrives in India and immediately gets a case of Delhi belly, which lays him flat for about 6 weeks. And he's working with his Parker fountain pen to draw a line for 1,700 miles, dividing the Punjab in eastern India into two. And the line is complete. Mountbatten says, and he does the same thing in Bengal in the east, we've now created a country, and in 3 days, you're all going to be independent. And this causes a massive turmoil of people, Muslims rushing into Pakistan, Hindus rushing out of Pakistan. 2 million people die. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible massacre. And Cyril Radcliffe, a broken man, burns all his notes, returns the fee, goes back to London. W.H. Auden writes a poem about him. It's such a tragic...
Devastating poem about him.
Devastating poem.
Speaking of poetry, yeah. You do not want a poem written about you.
No.
Yeah.
And then he eventually dies in London. But the border, 1,700 miles, which is between two nuclear-armed powers, is the only thing which can be seen, man-made thing, from the space station at night. It's just arc lights all the way through the Sindh and Punjab right up to the Himalayas. And there's only one opening, and that opening is at a place called Wagga. And I urge those of you, I'm sure most of you have seen it, go to YouTube and look at the Wagga border closing ceremony each night when these sentries, hugely tall Indians and hugely tall Pakistanis, loathing each other, march towards each other doing sort of Basil Fawlty Ministry of Silly Walks kind of thing, up to so their moustache, quivering moustache. And then they shake hands and slam the gates shut. And so the border closes for another night. It's amazing and ludicrous, but fun to watch.
You traveled all over the world to write this book. And some crazy, we had central Latvia to find the marker, and you had to pet the alpacas.
Yes, and indeed the alpaca woman wrote to me today, oddly enough, saying, are you sending me?
Small worlds colliding all day long.
It's quite extraordinary. So she wrote and said, can I have a copy of the book? Yeah, she...
In the course of doing the research for this book, and you're traveling to all these obscure places, did it ever, you've seen a lot, you've done a lot, did it ever occur to you, this might be a bridge too far? This is crazy. What am I doing here? Did you ever have any doubts?
Well, to suggest I didn't would be a terribly sort of arrogant and cheeky thing to say.
That's all right. We're arrogant and cheeky.
Hubris and all those things. Yeah. I thought at first, I mean, the next book I'm doing is even more sort of all-encompassing. But I think once you've sorted out the structure, then that imposes a discipline on you. So I knew that one chapter was all going to be about surveying and map making, that one chapter was all going to be about battles for land and partition and that kind of thing. So I think the structure sort of, it imposes a kind of order which makes a book possible to write.
Yeah, very much so.
So when you talk about map making, especially in the early days, from the time I was a small child, I was always amazed at the early maps of countries and the world that were drawn at a time when there was a dearth of global positioning satellites and aerial photography, but yet they got it pretty close to what it really looked like. How do you do that when you can't fly, you can't look at it overhead, you're just doing it all from the land, and yet they got it pretty right?
They did, and the chapter, I'm not going to say, there's a very good book about it, which I suggest you read, but I mean, talking about this thing called the Struva Geodetic Arc.
It's an incredible story.
Measured by this man called Struva, which actually took me to Latvia. He wanted to know, because they wanted to make accurate, really accurate maps, how big the world was. Exactly. I mean, Eratosthenes had done it pretty well 2,000 years ago, but they wanted to know, you know, within a few millimeters how big the world was. So to do that, you have to measure very, very exactly an arc of the meridian. And he chose a meridian about 25 degrees east of Greenwich, running from Hammerfest in Norway down to Odessa in the Black Sea, which runs through 10 countries now, from Norway and Finland and things like that. And you do that by lugging enormous theodolites. I mean, you do it by the principle of triangles, which you learn at school, it's very easy, except it isn't, because you have to be trekking through forests and rowing across lakes. And to be able to see above a forest, you have to build a rickety wooden tower and put your theodolite on top of that, measuring distances with these things called Gunther's chains. I mean, it's a fascinating story, I find, anyway. I get really nerdy about it. And it was decided a few years ago when everyone had forgotten the arc, and he got it right. I mean, he got it right to within precious few meters of what it is now measured by GPS and various other NASA things. He's been forgotten totally. So people discovered that all the old survey marks, usually stones with an X chiseled into them, which is the exact point below the theodolite, are still there in the forests, about 200 of them. And so they found as many as they could and made little clearings in the forest and little paths to them. And then the United Nations, bless their hearts, made it into a UNESCO heritage site. Now there are 200 odd things that you can go and see which indicate where Mr. Struve made this astonishing effort.
Am I remembering this correctly? He spent 40 years doing it, right?
Yeah, 45.
Yeah. 40 years, yeah. We don't do things for more than 4 minutes in this country now. 40 years. Wow. Okay, we are so going to run out of time, but there are so many wonderful stories in this book. But I'll give you your pick. You want to talk about the DMZ and what happened when humans went away? Do you want to talk about Ted Turner and John Malone, two fascinating characters? I happen to know both of them. Or the Aboriginals taking better care of their land than the so-called leaders in Australia?
Well, all of those. I think I'd sort of like to end it on a very sort of a polemical note, if I may, because you talk about Ted Turner, who owns just about 2 million acres, and John Malone, who owns just over 2 million acres. They have, I mean, it's all to do with bragging rights when you have that sure. much land. But the people that I find, and those two are, to a pretty good degree, stewarding their landholdings reasonably well. John Malone, they're worried about in Maine, because is he going to do a lot of clear cutting in some right. forests that he's lately bought? But the villains, to my way of thinking, are a couple of brothers called the Wilkes brothers. And they are from far west Texas. And while I cast no aspersions on their beliefs, they are very militant evangelicals who believe that God, the reason that they have got, each of them, $2 billion to spend, which they got from making fracking chemicals, bought out by the Singapore Sovereign Wealth Fund, is because God has set them on a mission to buy land. And so they have bought, I mean, they've gone out on a shopping spree like you wouldn't believe. And Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado. But the crucial thing is that unlike Turner and Malone, they exclude people from them. And so people who have hitherto said, you know, this land in the Rockies, which we go snowmobiling or snowshoeing or fishing or whatever on, now security cameras and barbed wire and security guards. And that seems to me not a good thing.
Yeah. Okay, here's my Ted Turner story. Because I primarily, Simon Winchester, used this show to tell stories. I was on one of Ted Turner's ranches many years ago in Montana. He had Montana, Nebraska, New Mexico. He had ranches in South America. I don't know if he still does. And this particular ranch in Montana was 150,000 acres. 150,000 acres. And he's driving a handful of us around. And I'm just trying to get my head wrapped around how big is 150,000 acres. And I said, Ted, how big is this? Expecting him to compare it to Rhode Island or New Jersey or something. And he looked at me and he goes, huh? He goes, oh, different weather patterns. And I said, what? And he goes, yeah, I get a call from the guys. It's so big that his land, that particular ranch, had different weather patterns. And he had guys who'd be tracking the weather. And that was when he started reintroducing the bison, which you talk about in your book, Land, Jane. I'm mentioning the book as often as possible. And at the time, this was probably 20 years ago, he was reintroducing bison and the cattle ranchers hated him for it. Hated him for it. But I think he does his best. I do too.
And let me just say, when I was living in Hong Kong, I had this weird idea of myself that I'd have a log cabin in the Rockies and write from there. So I bought 80 acres in Montana on Route 93 near Hamilton. And my wife at the time said, this ridiculous behavior. I mean, just grow up. So I sold it a year later. I bought it for $40,000. I sold it a year later for $80,000. So I made some money. About 5 years ago, I was in Western Montana and rang the real estate agent in Derby, I think it was. And she said, yeah, come and stay. And she was now incredibly rich because people have been buying land on Route 93 like it's going out of style. And my neighbors were Huey Lewis in the News, that young woman that was in Four Weddings and a Funeral, Ally McDowell, was it that her name?
Andy McDowell.
The mad professor guy, Christopher Lloyd, is it?
Christopher Lloyd.
I was very sad to leave them. But anyway, I had no money. So she took me eventually down. Do you want to see your land? And I did, and crossed the little rickety bridge and walked over. And there was a Mack mansion of unimaginable vulgarity. But I said, well, that's awful. But how much did the land cost? $1.25 million.
No.
I know. Painful.
Yikes.
Oh, wow.
I worked for Ted Turner, but I don't have a story.
He's great. Okay. Here's another Ted Turner story for you. In New York, and I'm with somebody, and we're passing the Jockey Club. Remember the Jockey Club? And Ted Turner comes out, and this was right after he announced that he was giving $1 billion to the UN. Remember that? I don't know if he ever did it, but he said he was giving $1 billion to the UN. And this friend of mine said, Ted, do you really know what you're doing? He goes, you know, whatever. So the next morning, I saw him at some meetings. I worked for the Cable TV Association. He was on the board. And we're just standing there waiting for some stupid meeting to start. So we're talking, this, that, whatever. And I said, Ted, when is enough enough? And he goes, what are you talking about? And I said, when is enough money enough? And he looked at me and he goes, oh, it's not about the money. It's about having more than the other guy. And to your point, Simon Winchester, he and John Malone fighting over who's the largest private landowner in the country. It was always about having more than the other guy.
So, you know, when
they were bested by a woman.
When Ted Turner pledged that $1 billion to the United Nations, he had a personal fortune of about $11 billion. But he made a classic investment mistake, which is that he held most of his assets in his company stock, in Turner stock. And he ended up losing at some point in the early 2000s, his net worth was actually like $1.8 billion.
Is that all?
I don't know how he scrapes by on that.
Yeah, but I don't know. Okay,
He did keep his pledge to send the money to the UN.
There are so many great Ted Turner stories. Okay, here's the last one, though. At this time, and we're out on his ranch in Montana, he was still married to Jane Fonda. And at this particular ranch in Montana, a nice, but nothing fancy, nothing ostentatious main house. And we walk in, and up above the fireplace is the biggest moose head you have ever seen in your life. Just ginormous. And I looked up, and I looked at Ted Turner. He goes, yeah. And he goes, bleeping, commie liberal Jane shot that one. I said, you're kidding. He goes, yeah. He goes, she doesn't want people to know that, but she shot that one. And then he goes, and it turned out it was an aging moose and it was going to die a sad, painful death off in the woods. But Jane Fonda, according to Ted, shot the moose. Okay. That is kind of related. Here's what I want to get you out with, Simon Winchester, author of Land, which is just fabulous. You have so many incredible stories in this book. You have so many remarkable people like Stuever. You could have dedicated this book to any one of a number of people. And this is a whole section we didn't get to. And you dedicated to Chief Standing Bear. Explain Chief Standing Bear and why you dedicated the book to him.
Up to 1879, Native Americans in this country weren't classified as human beings. They were creatures. They might have been groundhogs or something like that. But this Ponca, who lived in Nebraska, he was a chief and a very distinguished man too, decided this was wrong and that he was a human being and he should take his case ultimately to the Supreme Court. And in 1879, the Supreme Court ruled that Standing Bear, this Ponca chief, was indeed a human being and entitled to at least most of the rights that other humans who lived in the United States enjoyed. But they still took his land away. And that seemed to me to be very poignant and indicative of what has happened to Native Americans in this country.
I used to work for John McCain, who spent a lot of time in Arizona working with the various tribes across the state. And I asked him once, his biographers and everyone else did not share the story, but I asked him once, just kicking around on some campaign trail, I said, okay, the classic question, what do you want on your gravestone? And he looked at me and he goes, did something for the Native Americans, because he thought they were so royally screwed from start to finish. And absolutely right. I mean, they're wonderful stories, incredibly poignant stories in the book.
Let's hope that Deb Haaland, now being the Secretary of the Interior, being Southwest Pueblo Indian, can bring some sanity back to this situation.
Yeah. Right. Oh, from your lips to God's ears. Absolutely. Okay, we have Simon Winchester. Stay with us, because again, I said earlier, you have the best author website I've ever seen. And on your website, you have a word of the week, which is a fabulous thing. So just hold on to that, because I'm going to do a little housekeeping. And then we have a segment on the show we call Deserted Island, which is homework for Jamie and David, not for you. But here's the housekeeping, everybody. Thank you for listening. Download us, review us kindly, send us emails, etc. Come back next week when we are going to have Lisa Gardner, who has fabulous, fabulous book, suspense series. She does the Boston detective, Dee Dee Warren. If you're at all a Boston fan, this latest book that she has out is terrific. It's called Before She Disappeared, about amateurs delving into cold cases, which I think is going to be my next career. So Deserted Island, in honor of our very esteemed author, a word of the week. And I'm really excited about mine because Jamie and David have already used it this evening. But let's see, alphabetical order. David, you go first. What's your word of the week?
Unity, because it's so ridiculous to expect. And it's amazing to me that one side says you have to display unity, which by definition is whatever we want you to do. So unity.
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah.
That's kind of fun. One. Jamie?
Well, you know, I have a lot of favorite words. One of them is sesquipedalian, which I like to just drop into conversation.
Can you spell it?
Well, let me just break it down. It basically means given to using long words. The prefix sesqua basically is like 1.5. So a sesquicentennial is like 150 years.
Right.
So it's like using a word and a half when, you know, probably a smaller word would do. But my absolute favorite word that I learned when I was at the Pentagon, from your friend and mine, Tony, forgot his last name.
Dolan.
Tony Dolan.
Yeah.
Not going to define it. You'll have to look it up. He actually used it in a sentence, but the word is Calipigian. Calipigian. It's a particular word. It has a very limited but useful use. And I would recommend you Google
nice.
That one.
Nice. Calipigian. Okay, mine is evocative. And what makes me so happy is I thought of it because I was watching Amanda Gorman deliver the poem at the inauguration, our National Youth Poet Laureate. And I was just sitting there and I was so moved by how she was doing it, what she was saying. And I was like, wow, it's just so evocative. So then I looked up the word because I'm simple. And I thought, what's the difference between evocative and provocative? And provocative is annoying, harassing, designed to tick people off. And I thought, you know, go back to grade school, use the word in a sentence. Amanda Gorman was evocative. Donald Trump was nothing but provocative.
I think you have a poem there.
I've got a poem. That's it. And my little Willy poem. Simon Winchester, do you have a favorite word this week?
I do.
Go.
It's a very ugly word, but it just shows the majesty of the English language. The word is malmarocking. She's spelled M-A-L-L-E-M-A-R-O-K-I-N-G. And the interesting thing about it is its classical definition and the modern definition. It used to mean malmarocking. If you go to Chambers 20th Century Dictionary, which is my sort of go-to everyday dictionary, the carousing of drunken seamen on ice-bound Greenland whaling ships. That's what it used to be. Very, very narrow definition. But then in 1980, I think it was, the new edition of Chambers 20th Century Dictionary redefined it ever so slightly. It dropped the word Greenland and it said Malmaroking, the carousing of drunken seamen on ice-bound whaling ships. And this prompted a leader writer, an editorial writer on The Guardian, to write a very tongue-in-cheek editorial in a Saturday edition of the paper, saying, I noticed from the latest edition of Chambers Dictionary that the foul crime of Malmaroking has unleashed itself from its native Greenland and appears now to be spreading over the world. It must be stopped immediately.
Awesome. That is fabulous. We will end it there. Simon Winchester, it's just an honor, a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much. Encourage everybody listening, go get this book, Land. It covers, we just couldn't do justice to it in the time of the show, but it covers so many things. Just the most interesting, revelatory things about land and everything we're doing with land. Buy it at your local independent bookstore if you can. Claude, thank you for making everything happen, my friend. David, Jamie, love seeing you guys. Everybody out there, thank you for listening. Stay healthy, wear a mask, wash your hands, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody.
This is Chatter on Books. Use only as directed.